Welcome to the CNP podcast special episode in honor of National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day 2023. This episode was conceived by CNP's Narrative Justice Leadership Lab participants. This group features Ryan Canty, Anthony Carter, Cecilia Dennis, Thomas Epps, and special guests Henry Filial and Kenyon Farrow. Enjoy this conversation on access to care.
Hey, welcome to our podcast. Folks, my name is Thomas. I have some friends with me today.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Cecilia Dennis.
Hi, my name is Ryan Canty.
Good evening. My name is Anthony Carter.
Hey, thanks for being with us today. I want to kind of guide us through a conversation about how we have engaged our own healthcare. And so I can remember my earliest recollection of engaging with medical professionals is just with my pediatrician. I never had routine visits, but when I did go, the reason for my issues always was around my obesity. Right? I was an overweight kid and I'm an overweight adult. But as an adult, you know, you get your own healthcare plan. You know, if you have a job, you're lucky to have one or blessed to have one, right? Like, and I was empowered or emboldened to sort of be the manager of my healthcare experience. What I mean by that is, you know, I schedule and attend my routine appointments, and I arrive with some general knowledge, like about my health and if I'm experiencing anything new. I think my relationship with my healthcare provider is probably my most honest relationship. Because of policies that are sort of designed to protect me, I feel liberated enough to sort of share candidly about the things that I do as an adult, right, that may impact how my care, right, is implemented. And it gives my provider, I think, a clearer picture of, you know, how to keep me well. So I think this agency as an adult, right, the person who is coming to see my provider and managing my own healthcare, just has allowed me to choose a provider that has a niche for working with gay men. That's how I identify. And also helps me give regular feedback about things that I think are going well or not going well with my care. Cecilia, what about you?
For me, healthcare has greatly improved. I have a wonderful relationship with my provider. I'm able to converse with them and share my viewpoints on and concerns over treatment options. And I feel like I'm being heard. And you know, all of the other opportunities that have come over the years of living with this virus have been really astronomical. I've been in rooms with and in spaces where I could have never imagined myself being. I've been able to provide input and solutions to community issues, participate in this decision making as far as programs. And I've seen awesome improvement.
Ryan, thanks for joining us again today. What has been your experience with healthcare and medical profession?
I think as I've gotten older, it's gotten better. I think when I was younger, as a young adult, kind of moving through, like, you know, having insurance and not having insurance is always pretty much a catch-22. Depending on where I was, depending on where I lived in the country, sometimes the care would be really great, sometimes it'd be really horrible. And so I've had to learn throughout my life to learn how to advocate for myself, because no one's going to do it for me. And so I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten really good about being very clear and very specific about what I need, you know, what's going on with my health. And like you and everybody else, I can also have very, very candid conversations with my PC, you know, with my doctors about what's going on, what's going well, what's going wrong, you know, talking about treatment options. You know, luckily for me, even though I live in a part of the country that's not really all that progressive, I'm fortunate enough with where I live, the city I live in, where we do have a surprising amount of number of, like, queer health and queer health clinics. And so I'm able to go to one where, you know, I obviously have a doctor and doctors I go to at the standard hospitals, but with the, like some of the smaller clinics, I can go and get very specialized care. It's way less homophobic. And so I'm very fortunate, even to be the age of 47, to be lucky enough to have a good insurance plan where I can actually go in and get like the health, the care I need and not feel judged or not be, you know, treated in a negative fashion as I was when I was younger.
I think it's so important, Ryan, that you mentioned how we, you know, are finding clinics or providers, right, that have a niche for working with our community. And it's important because we want to be seen, we want to be valued, and we want our care to be taken seriously. So thanks for sharing that. Anthony, what about you?
Mine has pretty much, I think it's mirrored Ryan's in that I've had really awful experiences. I've had really wonderful experiences. The one that comes to mind that really stands out for me was when I was 19 and I was in the closet and you didn't talk about, you know, being gay and whatever that entailed. You know, this was in 1987. So this is when it was still, it was a very different, you're talking about almost 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago. So mine was very different. And I had a doctor who was a friend of my, friend of the family. And to this day, I still feel like that person terrorized me because I went in and I was scared and didn't know what was going to happen. I was scared about being in the closet and being found out and got treated for something I'm not sure I'm not sure I had. I got treated for an STD that I'm not sure whether or not I really had, but I was treated as such and then made to believe that I was lying and not. You mentioned sharing information with your provider. I was kind of pressed against the wall and made to believe that I wasn't being honest with my provider, right? This is somebody I didn't know. I'd only been in his company about a minute or two. And was kind of badgering me about, you know, my sexual practices and, you know, that type of thing. And it was really, it was an awful, awful experience. Fast forward to when I was in my 40s, I actually started, I had a really great healthcare plan when I was in California. And you know, everything was, it was one-stop shopping. So you could get the blood work, you could get all your work done, you could get eyeglasses, everything was in one building. Plus the parking was free. So I had a really great coverage in California. Now I'm in a position now, I'll be 55 next month. Well, I don't have coverage because I recently moved across the country and am really understanding the importance and the weight that, it's lifted off of our shoulders, off of your shoulders, when you have really great healthcare. Because I had Kaiser for 10 or 11 years, and I just kind of took it for granted. You know, it was cheap, everything was always available, there was no waiting, that type of thing. And when you don't have it, I often wonder now, like when I don't have it, I have to pay for something, you know, when I go in, it's out of pocket. It's got to go on a credit card. I've got to come in with cash. So yeah, it's important that you have that. And yeah, that's been my experience in 55 years, from 19 up until 55.
Thank you for sharing, Anthony. I will say I also know the trauma sort of moving and not having consistent or familiar healthcare provider. I remember transitioning back to Virginia at one point and because I was unemployed, I had to sort of navigate the Medicaid world. And what I experienced there was sort of a gap in my my therapy, right? My care. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed 11 years ago, right, with HIV. And so I had never not been, you know, had access rather to my medication. And so it started me for a minute. It jarred me because I didn't know how I would climb back, right, out of, you know, sort of a lack of adherence, right, to my medication. Mm-hmm. And so I understand what you mean by, you know, moving and sort of being uncertain. So thank you for sharing that.
I'd like to chime in on that. For me, my understanding is that systems of oppression still exist. We're still dealing with prejudice, discrimination, and misconceptions about people of color in healthcare. And it is utmost important that we advocate for ourselves, that we develop those relationships with our medical provider and be seen and heard as human beings. And, you know, the doctor, medical providers, they really do. They work for us. And often, well, some cases we are locked in because of the constraints with the insurances and access to care. But for many, we do have the option to fire our provider. You know, if my provider is not hearing me, if they're not seeing me as an individual, as a human being, I think it's in my right, it's my duty, it's my responsibility to seek care elsewhere. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about my life and my health.
I agree, Cecilia. Like, you know, even if you don't have to fire, right, your healthcare provider, like, arrive with some personal knowledge, right, of how you want to be in the care or how you want to be cared for. I think folks are able to tell you how they want to be loved, right, or how they want, you know, to be in a meaningful relationship. And I think the same sort of goals for the relationship with your healthcare provider. It is a relationship. How do you want to be treated in that space, and make sure they know that, and have those candid conversations. But I think if you're not engaging with your healthcare provider, one of the greatest tools, at least for me, right, was to find a network of folks. It could be, you know, a very discreet network of folks who can tell you how to navigate that world, or can share with you the name or names of healthcare providers, right, that they've had success with. And I think that, especially in my community and our community, right, that is one of the best sort of word of mouth recruitment or marketing tools, right, to help us find providers who care for us, right, to lean into our network, our friends, you know, those who maybe even, you know, living with some of the same things we live with, right, to say, like, who are you going to? Right. You know, is it a good experience? You know, how have you been able to sort of partner with them for your care? Right. And so get a referral from your friends and your network about how to, you know, find that person. And if it's not the person for you, right, then, you know, you keep moving. Right. But to be able to sort of engage and figure out, like, with the people that you already trust, right, as your friends or as your network, to name a provider, right, that may work for you, I think is very important in your ability to walk in your own power, right, to care for yourself.
I think what's been successful for me is pretty much I make the professionals, you know, not only if they have questions, if I ask questions, they answer those questions. I tell them to explain the procedures to me, like tell me what they're doing as they're doing it and why they're doing it. I think a lot of things with people, just general fears, is like, okay, you're doing this, but why are you doing this? And can there be an alternative? And will you explain that alternative to me? Like, I think it's just, that's been a big thing for me. It's just like, a lot of times they come and explain to me like I'm 6 years old. You know, like, just explain to me in like the very simplest of English, you know, if you're doing this, tell me what you're doing, why you're doing it, what the benefits of it will be. And I think that's been very beneficial for me when dealing with many doctors. I mean, it's kind of disarming for folks. They're just like, oh, okay, maybe I do need to treat them like a human being. Yeah, because I'm asking you to explain to me what you're doing and why. And also, if I don't feel comfortable with that, what's an alternative you can do to still get the end result that you're looking for, which is basically managing and like making sure my care is what it's supposed to be.
The CNP podcast is presented by CNP. Also known as the Counter Narrative Project. CNP is a nonprofit with the mission to shift narratives about Black, gay, and queer men to change policy and improve lives. Check out our award-winning program, Revolutionary Health, on YouTube and our GLAAD Award-nominated digital publication, The Reckoning, at thereckoningmag.com. To stay connected to the work of CNP, join our mailing list at bit.ly/joinCNP tribe. Now, back to the show.
My name is Ryan Canty. I currently live in Pittsburgh, PA, and I'm a domestic violence, intimate partner violence advocate.
And I am Henry Filial. I am a community influencer and a writer for The Reckoning and The Body.
Good morning, and I'm happy to have you. I think just in seeing what was going on last year with MPOX, I know you popped up as someone of note for me and many others, and like kind of dealing with the initial stages of it and, you know, trying to find access to the vaccine. And I wanted to ask you some questions about what your experiences were like then and how things are for you now.
Okay, absolutely. Well, part of the larger problem with MPOX was appointments. And I think that anybody going through last summer of 2022 realized that, like, that was the toughest part of it all. Most of my community, especially Black and Brown folks, were absent and getting appointments because our so-called allies in the white queer community monopolized all the appointments behind Grindr chats and keep the information private, so we didn't get appointments. Due to some grassroots efforts between me and another gentleman named Courtney and I made the effort to get people appointments that were a Black and Brown queer experience. I think the tougher part was just more so like the language around non-cis queer people was where we kind of like had the hardest journey of it all. But we were definitely focused, I think, for maybe 6 weeks getting people appointments. And the thing that was funny about it was, like, even my own appointment, I didn't get, like, on my own. Someone backdoored me through someone else. And I don't know who this person is. I don't know the person who set me up for my appointment. I don't know nothing about them. It was through my best friend, but they backdoored me through them to, like, oh, just call this number and they'll set you up. And I basically, like, created a whole account at this organization just to get an appointment. And even when it came down to my second shot, that was even a hellscape, because the second appointments didn't roll around when they were supposed to. So I was also getting tips from other people how to get secondary appointments. And because the work that me and Courtney were doing through an organization in New York, we didn't know anything about the second appointments either. We only were able to get people set up for the first. Okay. And the disappointing part about it is that there's a belief that Black queer people, Black and Brown queer people, do not want to be healthy, that the HIV/AIDS epidemic makes it seem like that we are just one of our wanton fours having sex and we don't care about our health and not anything. When it comes down to most studies and most information, it is mostly found that queer people do want comprehensive health care, and we do want to go to the doctor. We do want to be seen. And I think that in my experience as a queer person with my own health care, I've noticed the importance of it. And if somebody says, oh, there's a shot or a pill for it, well, baby, sign me up. Ain't not clear we're about to do it.
Right. So, and I also kind of want to go back more into, you were talking about you and Courtney. Tell me about what you two did, like kind of like the network you created, like how you came, like how it came about. Because I know when we talked in the summer, I mean, I'm not in New York City, I'm in Pittsburgh. I took a lot from what you were doing to kind of deal with my own advocacy and getting a shot. Because it's the same issue here.
Yeah.
Where like certain folks, you know, people didn't know about getting the MPOX vaccine. People who did know were white gay men who had their own same thing, access to Grindr and Jacked in different like chat rooms and like different text messages, chat, like all these things. And I only got access to the shots because I happened to have a casual relationship with someone at the Pittsburgh Health Department. Mm-hmm. And she said, you need this. I was like, well, okay, I know, but I can't get it because there are no appointments. She's like, I got you. And then put me in. And she was like, there's all these questions. Like, she was answering these questions. I'm like, well, most of these don't pertain to me. She said, lie.
Yes.
Say yes to all of them. It doesn't matter. She said, let's give you a story. He said that if she said, because at the time in Pittsburgh is a very good service, they were very much focusing on the sex and how much sex you were having. And she was like, Ryan, look, tell them you've been with like 20 men in like a month. I was like, that's not true. But if this is going to be the shot,
yeah,
Tell them 30. And I'll come up with names. So like, it was very difficult to get access to the mpox vaccine. And I just wanted to know, hear more about kind of like what you and Courtney did to like, what was the initial plan? Like, who did you, what organization did you pair up with? And what did that look like, that work look like leading up to like getting people to actually get the access to the mpox vaccine?
So basically, so this is the thing I think people don't realize, that New Yorkers, Black queer New Yorkers are, it's very much everybody's for everybody. And the thing that was so interesting was how quickly people were willing to share information about what was going on. And I think the thing that I appreciated was, in the midst of all of this, there were several Black and brown people who were openly talking about their symptoms, regardless if they were in sex work, not in sex work, how sexually active we were, regardless, which also helped destigmatize and bring a better conversation to it. With that being said, me and Courtney at the time, the organization he was working for had all these appointment slots. And he was like, Henry, I need to get these slots filled, but I can't get them filled. And he was just like, Henry, like, the girls love you. So you need to like go ahead and like maybe if you use your following and probably five people get appointments. I was like, well, girl, you know, I'm not afraid to talk to nobody. So child, let me go ahead and go down my Twitter. So the things of the way I started the process originally was that I went through the 3,000 some odd people that are following me. And I looked through this because like walking through the 20,000 people followed, it took me forever. I was like, that's not something I want to do. So I ended up going through the list, and I like literally I still have it at home, the list of everybody's screen names, and me really just like checking them off, writing them down. And instead of the, like a pre-written note via DM saying like, hey, you know, hey, it's Henry, this is not like, you know, no spam kind of thing. Like, you know, do you have a monkeypox appointment? I can get you one next day. Let me know, reach back out to me. A lot of people were like, yeah, I want an appointment. A lot of people were like, well, I'm not sexually active, like you just said, Ryan. I said, baby, you better go ahead and lie. Take some of the men I slept with. I've had plenty, many, in the world of Black Devereaux, many men. We all looked out for each other. And it was even strange because I'm getting reached out by people for appointments. I was reached out by people telling me to find an appointment because I was complaining on Twitter about it from people that like I haven't even sat in a room with before. One guy in particular led me to like all kinds of problems. Even though like by then I ended up figuring out through my best friend, but he was just like sending me information. And I haven't sat in a room with this man before, like at all. The crazy part is, we were only able to do these appointment slots 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. I'm at work during the daytime bartending. So I'm working 3 jobs and doing the appointments. So it was like literally like me just going and going and going and going. And me and Courtney set up it through my account, through me finding people. And of course, Courtney had his people that he was finding. But then like once I ran through my short list of people on my following list, I had to basically start blasting on the internet. Because I wanted to keep it discreet to a point that like it didn't like cause any alarms or I didn't get into any legal trouble or anything like that. I wasn't really breaking the law. I was kind of like utilizing the system like they utilize the system.
I mean, yeah.
And I'm for leveling the playing field. We deserve. I may not get us reparations tomorrow, but you know, let's start somewhere.
And again, I think others commend you for the work that you did, because you and Courtney really made sure that so many people had access. And that was something that like, even to this day, people still don't have access to the mpox vaccine, right? Like in certain parts of the country, still don't have it. You know, even though they act like it's died down because it's not an issue now, it's still out there.
Right.
And I know even just here, with me talking to people who like weren't really aware and weren't hearing about it in the summer, who are now hearing about it now, they're struggling to get access to even get the vaccine because they're not giving it out now.
Right.
Or they're not giving it out as much because it's not a priority, because now the priority is everything else.
Right.
And so, I mean, very much so. And I know we talk about giving people their flowers. And I know like, I'm glad that like when pieces like, you know, Washington Post and people started paying attention, that you showed up and like kind of as among the people who were doing that work in New York City, you know, I feel like I want to give you like very much say yes, thank you, because there are people that like you were signing, like people I didn't even I had casual relationships with New York City, and I was telling him to go to your Twitter. And, like, if you want it, go to him. Because, like, you can ask me. I'm, I can find, talk to public health professionals I know in the city who are working in that. Right. But, like, go to Henry. Like, he can basically get you where most people cannot right now, and that's getting you an actual appointment. So, like, you may have, like, literally serviced people I know and who, like, don't know you, but, like, just for me being, like, go to him. There's his Twitter. He has Instagram. Like, hit him up. Like, he is literally giving people access to getting people appointments. Like, if you want it, get one. And so I think definitely very much a huge thank you for the work that you did. And, yeah, even though a lot of us weren't in New York City, we were definitely taking pages from your book on how to get our own, make sure we were getting ourselves vaccinated, and also helping our friends in our communities to get vaccinated also. So thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, the thing about it is, like, I didn't do it. I think the thing that, like, even though I have a large following on social media, well, on Twitter in particular, I don't, like, utilize my following to lift my own self-esteem or for my own ego, none of those things. I saw that we had an issue. I wanted to be in the background of it as much as I possibly could, because I really don't like being front-facing at all in social media, because, you know, you never want to be the main character on social media, child. So I try my best to stay in the background a lot of times to keep me out of the mix. And I do this for a reason. I'm very intentional about it. So with that being said, it was just like, when people started thanking me, I was just like, I'm good. I'm glad y'all all right. And then the thing was that the Washington Post article happened because one of my mutuals told the Washington Post. And I was like, I didn't like reach out to the Washington Post. I didn't say like, oh, I'm doing this and I'm doing that, blah, blah, blah. And y'all should blah, blah. And then so like they reached out. And then once the Washington Post happened, then the German documentary happened. And once the German documentary happened, a health magazine happened. I did it because I think the secret to my platform is that, which I don't tell people, that I don't do this for me or for y'all. I do this for little Henry. I do this because he wasn't safe. He wasn't informed. He wasn't given opportunities to learn these things. So if I can pay it forward, that's what I'm going to do.
So can you tell me more about the GLAAD Facts and Vax campaign you were part of this year, or if it's still going on, what that's been like for you, and is this going to be an ongoing thing?
So the GLAAD Facts and Vax campaign is basically centered around Black and Brown people getting us vaccinated. The campaign is still ongoing. We are all actively using our platforms to keep people educated, direct them to GLAAD's website for more information about monkeypox. They chose several influencers of different experiences. The one thing that I will say that I do love about the campaign is that it is multi-generational, because a lot of times what happens, me being 42, I'm erasing the conversation. We're absent in conversations around sex, dating. Those things are multi-generational conversations, especially with queer people, because we lost a generation of people. So, like, right. I think it's important that those of us who are not in our 20s and our 30s definitely have a voice that's also relevant also. But it was nice to see a bunch of people of different experiences talking about their active work and make sure people get vaccinated. I'm still shocked I was actually invited to do the campaign. I also suggested to GLAAD that I do the Twitter spaces, because my Instagram is not like popping. Not Instagram girls. Twitter works for me. That's why I work so well, because I'm not a visual person. But it was nice to see that, like, it went over really well.
And final question. What do you think health departments, like queer health clinics, et cetera, can do better in regard to making sure everyone has future access to the Mpox vaccine?
Well, we have not noticed a trend via TikTok of how much medical professionals are unaware of non-white, non-cis, non-heterosexual identities in the medical field. They can do better. I think there needs to be a part of, like, a better racial and queer literacy that needs to happen with medical professionals. Ooh, also, yep. There needs to be a more, I don't know how to say the word, how I can describe this, but, like, an understanding of the needs of people who are, you know, who are not rich or not have immediate access, people who have like multiple kids, multiple jobs, multiple things going on, they need to diversify their information and how to manage those things. Because I think the larger problem that I've even seen over the years is that, like, luckily, once again, I've had great medical care in D.C. and New York. Didn't so much when I lived in Atlanta. I had explained to a doctor what PrEP was. That's a whole nother conversation for another day. But it's important that people diversify. Like from, I'll use me for an example. While I am a writer, and that's what I do, I'm also a bartender professionally. I've been bartending for 23 years. I have to still learn new things as a bartender every time something rolls out. I still have to go for education every year to make myself better at my job. So if I can do my shit off of tip minimum wage and still educate myself, why aren't you? Because you're making the big bucks, not me. So explain to me why you aren't making the effort to learn more about these other groups or how to work with them.
All right. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here, Henry. Really appreciate you and the work that you're doing, and yeah, like, have a good day.
Thank you so much, Ryan. This was amazing. I'm so glad to have done this. It's so great to see your face.
Hi, folks. My name is Thomas Epps. I live in Washington, D.C., and today we have a guest on our podcast, Kenyon Farrow. Now, Kenyon, for the folks who don't know you, who is Kenyon Farrow, and why is the work you do important?
Thank you for the question, Thomas. So again, as you just heard, my name is Kenyon Farrow, and I'm a writer and editor, also a policy strategist. Primarily have worked in HIV and prevention, treatment and care, advocacy issues, and then as well as worked in housing and homelessness issues, particularly as it pertains to LGBT folks as well. For over 20 years now. And currently the new vice president of policy with an organization called Point Source Youth, which does work on LGBT youth homelessness in cities across the country. And I'm also on two boards, and I'm board chair of two boards because I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm the board chair of the LGBT Center of Greater Cleveland, and also the board chair of NYTAG, New York Transgender Advocacy Group, based in New York City.
That's a lot of great work, Kenyon. So in our podcast, in our episode, rather, we've been dealing with access to care for folks living with HIV. And so as a journalist, what role does information sharing play in accessing quality healthcare?
I think journalism and kind of, you know, information sharing plays a huge role in how people access care. So first and foremost, I think in, you know, our, you know, kind of larger culture in America, HIV is still very stigmatized and very misunderstood as a virus, right? So a lot of the things that I think the larger culture became aware of in terms of medical and public health misinformation and disinformation that we saw over the last 3 years with COVID has been a standing issue for HIV for several decades, frankly. And so to me, that the kind of misinformation that people have about what the virus is, what it does, what the antiretroviral medication does, because people lack the basic sort of, you know, information about those things, it continues to fuel a very stigmatizing environment through which people who still get diagnosed in this country, particularly if they're from partly, you know, rural communities or even in big cities, right? We think a lot about the South, but frankly, I'm here in Cleveland, Ohio, and I can tell you that in many of the communities that are very disenfranchised, they're often disenfranchised also from quality health information. So even if you're in a big city, that doesn't mean that you're necessarily plugged into the same information channels that people with means in that place have. And so I think that because of that, It definitely shapes how people think about getting tested for HIV if they still are afraid to know their status, what people think having an HIV diagnosis means, and they think it's an automatic a death sentence, even with medication. They certainly, in many cases, still do not know what being virally suppressed or undetectable means, or don't know what PrEP is for that matter for prevention. And I think those the lack of baseline sort of public knowledge around those things really hampers efforts to increase access to treatment and care for folks.
You're totally right. Like, just as we have dialogued on our own, right, our group about access to care, I think all of those topics have come up. And it's really interesting to hear you talk about how those things play out in major cities as well, because we often think about the things that rural towns don't have and the misinformation there. So thank you for pointing that out. If you'd like to share, what has been your personal experience with accessing healthcare?
It's interesting. In some ways, I've been very lucky or fortunate in my life to some extent. So I grew up here in Cleveland in a housing project until I was about 5 years old, until I was about 14. And I was lucky enough that right directly across the street from my project building was a clinic. Here in Cleveland, we have a public hospital system called Metro Health. And when I was a kid, there was a Metro Health clinic right across the street. And so my pediatrician was there. And my mom, made sure, we saw the doctor, at least for annual physicals and every year. And obviously, if we needed, kind of other things, shots and vaccinations, all those kind of things, et cetera. And so I grew up with an understanding of how to use healthcare to an extent that not everybody gets, unfortunately. And so by the time, I recognized myself as, a gay man, Black gay man. I was already, at least understood, what having healthcare kind of, means or whatever, like how to, get annual physicals, et cetera. And so it was a little bit easier for me. Then I was, blessed once I graduated from college to, for the most part, for most of my adult life, even, sometimes when I was making not a lot of money, to have access to healthcare for a good chunk of time, right? So, I was very lucky in that sense. So once I had healthcare as an adult, I just folded getting tested for HIV and other things into, that, what I already, did in terms of healthcare. And so in some respects, I feel lucky or fortunate in that sense. I think one of the things that became clear to me as an adult, although I was doing, I was the policy director for Treatment Action Group, right? And at that point, I was a policy director from 2013 to 2017. And in 2015, I decided to get on PrEP. And it was getting on PrEP that actually made me understand from a very personal level a lot of the things that we talk about in terms of access to care for folks. So, basically I, went to my doctor. I was like, I'm ready to get on PrEP. And, he was like, cool. We took all the STI tests, et cetera. And so he was like, okay, I'm ready to write you a prescription. Wrote the prescription, said, where do you want me to send it? I was like, the pharmacy down the street from my house. So by the time he sent the prescription and I was walking out of the building on my way to my car, I got a call from that pharmacy chain and said, hey, we just got your prescription. We can't fill it, right? And I was like, what? I don't understand. So I went back in the doctor's office. They talked to the nurse practitioner. She said, okay, well, I don't know what happened, but let's see if we can just fill it downstairs in the pharmacy in the building. Great. Send it there. I went downstairs. They called my name, said, we can't fill it. And that was when I learned about prior authorization, right? And the fact that because the drug costs, right, of the medication was so high, the insurance companies had all these hoops you have to jump through in order to get it. And it took me 2 days of back and forth phone calls and fighting in order to get the actual prescription, you know, through the pharmacy I wanted to. But then for several years, I had to still go through the specialty pharmacy to have it mail ordered to me, which wasn't convenient for me all the time because I travel a lot for work. I always had to try to figure out when I could be home to get the package. A couple of times I had to have them send it to a hotel where I was staying at because, you know, it's like all this drama. And so that gave me a different appreciation for, A, we're asking, you know, young Black gay men, trans women, et cetera, to access a system that they may not have the same sort of experience that I've been lucky to have, kind of understanding a little bit more how to navigate through my life. But then certainly as working on policy issues, right, more kind of self-efficacy in that sense, number one. But number two, that for people living with HIV, this is still the reality, right? And so we tell people all the time how easy it is because we have Ryan White or we have these different systems that pay for medication or supposedly pay for care. But the administrative burden on the patient to access those things is still so incredibly burdensome and ridiculous that it gave me a different appreciation for, one, what people living with HIV still have to do in order to like access care. And two, in a situation for prevention where we're asking people who don't have a chronic condition, so people who are on PrEP don't have a chronic condition, but to basically have to engage the healthcare system as if they do, right? And, you know, which doesn't make sense, right, in that sense. And so explains to me a lot of people who fall in and out of PrEP access, right, or in people I know, even people I know in this work who work in HIV organizations, who fall out of, you know, their antiretroviral care because they get tired of the hoops they have to jump through to deal with the system. And so for me, you know, that is kind of how I understand, you know, my own experience in the healthcare system, where I was somewhat privileged, even being poor, but having the privilege of a mom who kind of taught me how to use healthcare system, you know, but also understanding the complications and the hurdles that people have to deal with every day when they're just trying to manage their own health, whether positive or negative.
Absolutely appreciate that response because my own experience, right, has led to my knowledge increasing, right, about how to navigate, you know, my own medical professionals, and accessing my medicine, right? Especially having to use a mail order pharmacy, which is a layer that I've had to help folks navigate because it's something different, right? You've never had to do it before. You have to, you know, get reminders and all sorts of things. And that prior authorization is a major piece, but it is the experience, right? I'm glad we used that word because it's the experience that you have with it that I think helps you become comfortable, right, navigating that world. As people say, like, you don't know what you don't know, right?
Right.
You've been a great guest, and you share some amazing information with us today, Kenyon. I want to close out by asking you a personal question, but a professional question at the same time.
Sure.
So if it was a perfect world, what would the next big headline be on HIV, and how would you tell it?
Wow. Okay. So I think that the headline is, you know, essentially that we have the, you know, tools to do better by HIV. I think that, you know, the knowledge of what viral suppression means for having, you know, access to treatment has still not become a national headline in any real way. I talk to people every day who are still kind of walking around with, the last time they paid attention was when Magic Johnson announced he was positive. Then they heard about the cocktail drugs. And then we spent, you know, 10 years in the early 2000s talking about men on the down low. Any of the scientific advances have, like, completely missed most people. And so I think, like, to me, the headline is still, we have these great tools. Now let's actually create systems that help people access these tools better and in more sustainable ways than we currently have in this country. And I think to me, that's that is the conversation. That's the headline that we need to have. Like I have said, you know, for the last several years that I really wish, you know, much like we saw in the mid 1980s when Surgeon General C. Everett Koop sent those notices to every household describing what HIV was, how it was transmitted, et cetera. We need a national level set like that, right? And we need to meet mailers to everybody's house describing viral suppression, U equals U, describing PrEP, et cetera, giving people tools to access those things and to get tested, right? As well as like national campaigns that do, you know, media strategy, have people, you know, talk to social media influencers, YouTubers, you know, et cetera, to really change what people's just baseline understanding is of what it means to have HIV, which I think will go a long way towards some of the stigma and persistent misinformation and disinformation that we know that exists, particularly, you know, in respect to Black folks in this country.
You know, you have a point there. I think if HIV was not still so stigmatized, right, I think that folks who were living with it, right, would be more comfortable sharing, right, the truth, right, about the science, about living, and there would be, I think, a greater body of general knowledge, right, about it. But alas, right, folks are scared, right, to speak their truth because they don't know how they'll be received. Kenyon, thank you for joining us this evening. This was a great chat with you, and tell folks how they can reach us.
Sure. So folks can reach me on kind of all the social media channels, just my name at KENYONF as in Frank, ARROW, just at Kenyon Farrow, you know, all the social media platforms, or my website, which is just kenyonfarrow.com. And there's a form there if you want to reach out to me directly via email to do so.
Awesome. Well, we thank you again. And folks, go follow Kenyon. Have a great night.
Thank you very much.
Has anybody had any like gold star stories about, you know, their experience now, like, you know, what you should look forward to, or what somebody listening to this podcast should look for in a dynamic provider to keep us well?
Sure, I can add to that. I think first and foremost, you want to have an open dialogue and be able to converse with all of your medical providers, because it's so important to be able to open up and be honest about your experiences and for them to hear you in order to treat you properly. Stigma is a thing that we always have to overcome. And I look at that when I face stigma, especially in the medical arena, I view it as an opportunity to educate and inform. We assume that medical providers are current, up-to-date, and educated on HIV and it's being a chronic condition and U equals U, and, you know, the advances that we have made. So whenever I face those challenges, I take it as an opportunity to educate and inform. What I'd like to see is more people of color, people of trans experience, and especially cisgender women included in research. I'd like to see us doing more advocacy nationally and in our own communities. I think it's very important that we reduce stigma and inform and educate folks, not only about our own condition, but the reasons that they should be aware and informed, so that we can all overcome this virus. Also, in the ideal world, I think we'd all be looked at as humans, be treated as human beings, deserving of everything that any other human being is afforded and given the resources or the ability to obtain the resources that are needed to just stay healthy and stay alive.
For me, I think a big thing, what I'm looking forward to is more community healthcare, because not everybody is comfortable going to the standard hospital, the big box hospitals that we know, like the Blue Cross Blue Shields and like the UPMCs, which is big out here. I think just, you know, and also because so many reasons, people aren't comfortable, they don't feel safe. If you're, you know, someone who is queer, who is trans, who is non-binary, you do not feel, nor are you presented with options of care and safety that respect you. So you want to go somewhere where you can get the respect and care, adequate care you need. And I feel like you'll get that in community healthcare, you know, just more smaller clinics, doctors who are trained in like issues of diversity and inclusion and can like better access and like respectfully care for the patients they have. And also opening it up to like low cost healthcare at that. I mean, a lot of community health clinics are very much more for all, open to all, and they'll take you however you have. If you have insurance, if you don't have insurance, they work with you. And I think it's just, that's the big thing I'm looking for, is like more community healthcare clinics across the country, specifically in places where a lot of people don't have access to healthcare and they're like marginalized, like people who are down south and people in like various, a lot of states where like, you know, seeing they're like big, they're mostly hit, they've been hit a lot by the abortion bans, and like just having those alternatives there would be, I think, would benefit so many people and would help so many people out with just getting basic health care, which is something that we all need and is a right to all of us.
Yeah, I think community health is super, super important. I'd really love to see a movement around wellness. And what I mean by that, and Miss Cecilia and I were talking about that earlier, to me, wellness is not just the absence of being sick or the absence of not having, you know, some type of illness. Wellness is a big circle that encompasses everything. You know, are you being able to create? Are you being able to contribute to the community and the world at large with your talents, your gifts, and your skills? All of that to me is part of wellness. You know, who you partner with or who you don't partner with, or maybe you're partnering with a whole bunch of people. So my dream, my thinking would be, in order for us to truly get well, we have to get well as a community in a way that everybody's humanity matters and everybody gets to share their humanity on an ongoing basis.
I think of having our humanity right at the forefront of our care really eliminates the barrier for how we feel about even accessing the options for care that are provided to us already. Knowing that we are seen in the space, we're respected, our providers have deep knowledge and an understanding of how to care for us. But just understanding that we are the drivers of our health, we are the managers of our health, super important. Knowing that we can own our own care and be in partnership with our medical providers is super important to how we experience health care. Hey, thanks, folks. I really appreciate this conversation today. I think it'll go further, and I hope folks who get a chance to listen to this understand, you know, what's next for them or where the bright line is for them in their access to care.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this special episode of the CNP Podcast. This series was produced by Johnny Ray Cornegay III, with production support from Brandon Nicholas, Christopher Sutton, and yours truly, Ben Robinson III. CNP is a nonprofit, and your support for our work is so much appreciated. To donate to CNP, visit thecounternarrative.org/donation. Thank you so much.